Welcome, everyone, to the session 277, How Did I Find Myself Here? Reflections on Later in Life Faith Transitioning. Oh, it is there. Okay. It's typical Sunso stuff. You're going to be embarrassed if your phone rings, so you might as well take care of that. Those kinds of things. Q&A afterwards. Respect for everyone's journey, as this is going to get personal. Can't help but be personal. This is one of those sessions. Sessions being recorded. If you have a favorite moment here, and plus if there's any of the other seven that are going on right now that you want, just know you'll be able to purchase recordings. I'm sure today's recordings will be up by tomorrow. You can download them onto a flash drive. It's a really great way to pick up Sunstone things these days. This session's 90 minutes long, and everybody's going to be here so that we have plenty of time for a discussion. We're all thinking you should have at least 30 minutes to share your own thoughts and experiences as well. James Fowler, my other favorite William, or my other favorite James besides William James. He mentions in stages of faith. There's that progression that all stage theories are sort of mirror each other. But for him, the natural time for somebody to really step into new worldviews and to kind of begin to deconstruct their own, inherited worldview, it's usually in young adulthood. It's usually at college time that you go off, you leave your home, and you leave that environment that kind of gave you your values and things for the first time. You leave your family out there. And then you go and you encounter new ideas. Sometimes it'll be the new ideas through your studies. But often it's who you associate with, right? It's going to be those wonderful friends that just completely add up the world differently than you do. And yet you can't help but deny that they're moral folks, that they actually have, there's a beauty and a truth there. And so that usually will typically trigger the process of beginning to look at what you had inherited with the eyes of an outsider, to take that step back and to do it. The famous line from the book, I don't think it was a Fowler line originally, we don't know who first discovered the properties of water, but we're darn sure it's not the fish. When you're swimming in it, you don't reflect on it. And so that's that normal young adulthood. Well, with our panel today, and I know with many of you here, that's why you're here, that process didn't happen. You married young. You only attended institute, functions rather than going to the pubs with your friends in college or something like that. And it didn't happen. And then you start a family. And then you start raising children. And you've begun to duplicate what you were raised with and things like this. And then stuff happens. And so it's a later in life faith transitioning that we're going to talk about today. Nothing to blame. There's no, oh, I was so late doing this. It's just the way it is. But it presents its own wonderful challenges and things. And these are four people who I really admire the way they're doing this late in life journey. So our first presenter. I know everybody. I could just wing introductions here. Our first presenter is my wonderful friend, Geralee Renshaw. She and I have probably been hanging out for 5-6 years now. And we're co-moderators of the group, a thoughtful faith support group. She is absolutely the star, the glue, the main cog there. And I've just never seen anybody who's more loving and accepting and open to everybody, even as she journeys. And I'm sure she'll tell quite a bit about that. Matt Jones, a new friend. I'll let him share anything that he wants about his Mormon He's in a very interesting position right now within the church. But he's an entrepreneur and a business owner in Seattle, Washington. They live in Bothell, Washington. And, oh, it says right here that you serve as an LDS bishop, so I can't do it. So it's not a secret. So, okay, I was just trying to protect that. I was not doing a very good job because you all come up, what's your interesting position? But Matt's a sitting bishop, and he's a wonderful contributor to lots of discussions. He's been on Mormon Matters podcast with me before, and just really appreciate his insights. Our third one, we're just going woman, man, Christina Ulligord, I don't know how to say it. She told me at times, I don't have an ear for that stuff. Tenney is somebody that I think a lot of you are on Facebook will recognize her as just a wonderful commentator. She's got a beautiful spirit. She converted into the church at age 16 in Stockholm, Sweden, where she's from. And it's only been about 6 or 7 years? 4 years. Oh, that you've been here, married to Richard here in the front row. It's a wonderful story, and they're in a journey. And it's a great one. Kevin Cap Perry was serving as his stake young men's president in the stake young men's presidency when he first experienced a faith crisis 2.5 years after his wife Kim had begun down that journey. So Kevin, in many ways, will represent the person who didn't initiate, who kind of stumbled into it, was kind of led kicking and screaming. But I've just loved the way that he is taking it on and negotiating difficult stuff with his family over this. So Kevin's an engineer. He works in the mining industry now, but I know his original engineering was in Seattle area at Boeing, wasn't it? Yes. So great. They're all just great friends, and I hope you'll welcome them. And Jerly, turn the time over to you first. Don't you prefer people here? Because it feels like there's more energy, I think, when a person's speaking. That's my problem.
It can hide my notes, too. I'm happy about that. So a couple of months ago, my friend Dan Witherspoon invited me to go to lunch and said that Matt Jones was going to be in town. And he was somebody we had only ever known each other through the Internet. So I was super stoked to go to lunch and meet Matt. And I always enjoy being around Dan. And at lunch, Dan said, I want you to be on a panel at Sunstone. So that's how I find myself right here today, and I've been questioning it ever since. But honestly, I was born under the covenant into a pretty ideal, loving LDS home where the gospel and the church was always at the center. I would say my childhood was happy and full of love, and I felt safe. I married in the temple to one of the best people I know. Together, we have raised 4 children, 2 sons and 2 daughters, and those were very happy years when I look back on that time.
Your husband's asking for that.
Sorry.
Repeat the married to the husband.
Okay.
Who's one of the best people?
Oh, my husband's asking for me to repeat that part. Okay, good. Yeah. I'm married in the temple to one of the best people I know who happens to be here today. You want to raise your hand, honey? We've raised 4 children, 2 sons and 2 daughters, and looking back, those were very happy years in our life. We've spent most of our lives being 100% focused and dedicated to the church. It was what defined us for the most part. We have both served in many leadership positions. My husband's been a bishop and I've been a Relief Society president, and we've had lots of other callings in between there. These were years when I used the words, I know, often as I taught lessons and bore testimony. I did feel that the church had the answers for just about everything, and I was grateful to be a part of that. Looking back now on that time in my life, it is as if we were living in a simpler time when we thought we had it all figured out. So how do I find myself here? None of those years of living and loving life fully entrenched in the church prepared me for the day about 6 years ago when our oldest child, a son, then married with 2 children while in a PhD psychology program, came to us and began to share the story of the unraveling and almost complete deconstruction of what had once been a strong faith, testimony, and commitment to the gospel and the LDS church. Nothing in all of my happy years of growing up and raising my own children in this faith prepared me for that day. I found myself in a very real world of hurt and fear like I had never experienced before. This was not a part of my plan. This was not the way it was supposed to go. It was not only an emotional experience for me, but the pain and the fear almost was a physical experience. I knew of no one at that time that I could talk to about this, as I was so afraid that my son would be viewed by other people as being off the path, the black sheep, or having lost the spirit. And even though I was in a world of hurt, that did not feel right to me. Google became my friend when I didn't know where to turn or who I could talk to, and as I typed in words like faith crisis, I found a Mormon Stories podcast with my friend Dan Witherspoon, where he shared his story. He was a guest on the podcast, and he shared about his own journey while in a higher education program that sounded similar to what our son had experienced. I emailed Dan after listening to him tell his story, asking for some advice. I could see that my son was grieving and in pain. And my question for Dan was, how do I handle this new situation and do the least amount of harm to my son, who is already hurting? To my surprise, a few days later, I received a very long, very thoughtful response from someone who at the time was a complete stranger to me. One of the things he said in his response was, no matter what our son chose to do moving forward, I needed to learn to honor his journey. Those words in that message has been really great advice and powerful for me, and something that I have turned around and shared with other people as I have heard their stories that were similar to this. And I want you to know that it took me some time to get here, but I think I am there now in honoring his journey. I felt that if this could happen to this child of mine, it could happen to anyone. He had always been obedient, humble, and believing. He served in many leadership callings, including in a bishopric while he was at BYU. I needed to understand what had happened. My mother heart knew that he was and is one of the best human beings I know. And if this could happen to him, I needed to understand how and why. I could not simply see him as the black sheep who had gone astray. And yet at the time, that's all I knew how to do. I could not wrap my heart and mind around that thought, so I set out to learn and figure this out. I have now spent countless hours listening to podcasts, reading, seeking, and studying about all of the difficulties. Polygamy was the first thing I pulled off the shelf, as I had very carefully placed it up there many years before after reading the Work in the Glory series. And I labeled it, I don't like this, and I don't get it. It is for me at the foundation still of my questions and difficulties to this day. It seemed that the more I read and learned, the messier and uglier it got. I have now given myself permission, after years of wrestling, to settle in a place where I no longer believe it was a practice that was inspired by God. At some point in the midst of all of this, my husband came home from work one day, and upon seeing me entrenched in yet another podcast, he said, I think you should give equal time to reading scriptures and things that are uplifting. I'm not very proud now of my response, but what I said at the time was very simply, I did that for 50 years. Now I want the truth. So I have picked up just about every problematic issue and examined it to some degree, only to find that I may not ever really know the truth in a capital T sense of the word. They say that life begins at the end of your comfort zone, and that is certainly where I had found myself at this point, at the end of my comfort zone. 6 years later, our four adult children are all over the spectrum, with one completely out, one all in with her family, and two somewhere in between on the spectrum of belief, but leaning more out than in, I'd say. While we try to teach our children all about life, it is often our children who teach us what life is all about. And I have really found that to be true in my journey. Another thing that I have learned is that life and belief are both very complex issues. And yet, despite the flaws, frustration, and messiness, I'm still here. I feel like this is who I am, my tribe, my people, and I am finding that the variety of belief and practice has a broad range, and I am growing more comfortable with the little space I have carved out within it. And although every day in my online community I hear others discuss the pain and the difficulty, I have grown somewhat tired myself of picking up every stone and examining it with great scrutiny. It feels like pushing a massive boulder up a never-ending mountain. One thing I think I know for sure through this faith process is that I can never be sure about anything I know. For years I have thought and claimed to know many things, and now I find myself in the very interesting place at 57 years old of the older I get, the less I claim to really know about anything. A good friend of mine once said it to me like this: I don't know, for me, is a destination, not a stop along the way. I am finding this a comfortable resting place, one where I feel my heart and mind can be left open to many possibilities. It helps me to be more patient with the more black and white thinkers and believers in my life. I often find myself frustrated by things people say at church or in my extended family. And then I rewind back just a handful of years and can hear myself saying those very things. And that actually gives me hope. Hope that we are all on a journey of development that often stretches us to our limits. On my shelf, I am holding space for these people, as I often preach big tent Mormonism in A Thoughtful Faith, and I realize that in this big tent, there needs to be a place for the very believing. They are also there with us, those of us in the borderlands. And when I hear someone say something that is a little crazy-making, it is a reminder to me that not too long ago, I was once where they are now. And who knows what might come into their path or journey that may be as unexpected as my own was. I don't have much room in my heart for excessive meetings, hurtful policies, church handbooks, regulations, or discrimination of any kind. But I do have room in my heart for people, especially those with questions and who are struggling with belief. I have room in my heart for King Benjamin. I have room and am open to spiritual mysteries. I think community is something that many of us can find value in within Mormonism. It's like oxygen or water for many of us. In my lived experience, my Mormon community has been mostly a net positive. This has become a bit more difficult as my views and beliefs have shifted. I think I'm trying hard to get to the point that even with all of the issues in the culture and doctrines and things I have taken off of my shelf, what does all of that really matter? Am I seeking a perfect church or organization, or am I seeking a community and kinship and a connection to divinity through my fellow men? I won't find perfection anywhere, and I don't think I'm seeking it. I'm seeking to be part of the body of Christ, which to me is simply a linking of our hearts. I have experienced this link in Mormonism. It can be found elsewhere, I know, but in my heart of hearts today, I'm seeking it here. I am far from what I once was and not yet what I'm going to be, and the Mormon story still explains who I am better than any other story I know. Thank you.
Can you hear me with that? Okay. I am grateful for all of these stories here. It's fascinating to hear the particulars of them, but that was wonderful, Jerilee. Thank you. I grew up in Southern California. A dad that was kind and funny and pretty straight down the line. He was a bishop for 7 years, but just a wonderful person that I was very close to. And a mom who would be very much termed a searcher, a seeker. She was always looking. And when I grew up, she was doing transcendental meditation and dream analysis and health food and lots of different things that I just didn't really pay too much attention to other than that they were there. I had books that were magazines that were around the house, Dialogue and Sunstone. I never picked them up, but they were there. I remember seeing them. When I grew up more out of curiosity, I liked to study things, and was really Western thought, logic, and literalism was probably where I came from. I went on a mission to Ecuador, and while I was there, I learned to work really hard and to follow the rules and to have fun, and that really led me to a worldview of more Western thought and literalism in terms of the church. That was a lesson that was very apparent to me at the time. There was another lesson that I learned that I didn't recognize until later, and that was how much I loved the people of Ecuador, whether they were members or not. That became more clear as I got older, but it was just a wonderful experience, and those people are in my DNA. When I got back from my mission, I was sitting around the house one day, and I found a copy of Sunstone, and I picked it up, and there was an article in there on missionary folklore. Do you remember that one, Dan? And oh, it was absolutely fascinating to me. And there was these stories in there that they would talk about things that you've heard about on your mission. And I was like, wait a minute, that happened in my mission. But it was all over the place. And of them, probably 50% of the stories I'd heard, there were minor variations to them. But I remember going, I thought all those things happened in my mission. I mean, that was my deal. And so that introduced a little bit of nuance to me. I remember thinking, wait a minute, that means it isn't just the way I thought it was. And so as I continued on studying Lot's and thinking through things, I really came to the conclusion that if somebody just gave 3 months of intensive study to the gospel, they would just convert. And the only reason everybody wasn't converted is because they hadn't studied it. But it was everything fit inside of a box. And that made it really easy. But I really believe that anybody would come to the same logical conclusion that I had. This literalism, the nuance of that came to me in my own way of some of the things that I read. So I'll give you an example of how my mind sometimes works. But I remember looking up or reading an article on Goliath that said that he was like 9.5 feet tall. And I was sitting there going, okay, so if they're like 5.5 feet tall, the average person. He's 9.5 feet tall. I mean, he's gigantic. And so I was thinking, he's got to be really lumbering, a really lumbering guy, and probably doesn't have quick twitch muscle reaction. And so I was like, you could get up close to him. If he just had a sword, you could get up close to him. You could like run circles around him. And I really thought to myself, I think I could take him. I mean, I just was like, why did they put that story in? It's not that big of a story. If he's that big, then it was a relatively easy fight. But that was my literalism going along. The other one that I had was I had read The Miracle of Forgiveness, which I think is out of print, isn't it? They should have called... Actually, that...
Is this on Bishop's shelves?
Not on mine. Yeah, not on mine. But they should have... Actually, the title of that book should have been Instant Anxiety. But in reading that, there was a story in there from church history about a guy that was sitting on a horse, and then he has this guy come up to him that's eye level, so he's probably 8 feet tall, and it's Cain. Did anybody remember that story in there? And I was like, oh my goodness, that's right. He's a wanderer on the earth, and he's going to be going along. And so I sat there and thought, wait a minute, so Cain's still alive. When Noah had the ark, he must have been hanging off the back of the boat. Like, let me up. And they were like, no, he can't. I don't have a wetsuit. It's really cold in the water, and I'm having a hard time because I can't eat anything. I mean, I was like, how did he figure in? How did he make it through the flood? So these things, if I'm, my own brain, and I knew they were funny at the time, it was just the way I kind of thought of how it was. And it became a bit nuanced to me in terms of allowing something else. The other one was that as I literally read about the God of the Old Testament, and a lot of people have felt this, I just felt like you had to walk on eggshells around God. She didn't know what was going to happen. And I remember thinking to myself, gosh, if that's really the way he is, do I want to spend an eternity with him? Of like constantly waiting to see if he's going to love me or swing the bat. And so that again brought that in. And when I was in my 40s, in the 20s and 30s, like a lot of people here, race in the priesthood became an issue for me, trying to figure out how it happened. And I finally came to the conclusion they must have gotten it wrong, which is not that big of a conclusion to come to. But for me, I remember thinking, I think they just got it wrong. Flat out, got it wrong. And I talked to people, and they'd give me the reasons why that wasn't true. And I remember talking to somebody one time, and I said, I just think they got it wrong. And this guy said, well, yeah, maybe that's the case. And I said, well, how could that be? How could that be that he got... I mean, that's a major issue. Why wouldn't God tell him that that wasn't the case? And he made this comment to me, which is kind of a duh. But he said, well, God doesn't necessarily clear up your misconceptions. And that opened something up. I was like, oh my goodness, that's true. He lets you come to those on your own, all the way up the chain. And that was that was just something that opened me up to the idea that things were different. In my 40s, I had a period of time in about a year of intense business pressures. My dad passed away, and my wonderful wife, who's here, was diagnosed with cancer. And so in that time, when those things came in and that pressing came in, I went outside, and I literally cussed God out. I was so ticked off. This can't be it. All of these things I've done, and this is what I get. This just isn't fair. I don't like it. And I mean, when I say cussed him out, I cussed him out. And when I did, and I was done, I felt this overwhelming feeling came over me that said, "That's okay. I understand. And I understand how you feel." And that again introduced the idea that God was different than I had imagined. And so as I went into my 40s, I found out all of the things Joseph Smith, polyandry, Book of Abraham, the denials of polygamy, and as I really studied those things, like Geralee and her son, it was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? And the advantage that I had was that I had this mom who had already been through it, unbeknownst to me. And so I called, and I spent tons of phone calls with my mom talking about what I was going through, and she just listened and allowed me to come to my own conclusions. And that was huge, was somebody that just listened to me. And that helped me to get somewhere around the idea that I could reconcile it. With that came issues of not being able to feel the same way about certain things as far as the gospel was concerned. There's a loss of innocence. And that hurts. It's grieving. It's like, gosh darn it. People would say things, and I go, I don't feel that way anymore. I can't feel that way anymore. And it was a crummy feeling. I mean, I just felt like it's never going to be the same. However, as I came through some of those things, at the same time, I remember thinking to myself, if somebody put a button in front of me that said, you can go back in the box right now, would you do it? And I knew that I wouldn't. That it was I was better off where I was than going back in the box and not knowing what I knew. And so that helped me to, for lack of a better term, reconcile. So there is no real reconciling of it. There's moments I have still to this day, and that journey opens before you, and it's all in front of you, and it's hard. 4 years ago, I was called to be the bishop of the Bothell Ward in Seattle. And it kind of freaked me out because, you know, my wife knows of my beliefs and where I'm at, but not everybody does. They probably know I'm a bit of a thinker, but I didn't know if I could legitimately do it. And I felt good about it, and I took that on, and it has been an amazing experience for me in the sense that so much of that nuance plays a huge part in my role as a bishop. So I have everything from true believing members that are right down the line, and I have those that are nuanced, and I have those that are upside down because have Google as their friend. And I can sit and listen and talk with them. I have found that I can tell you that the church is wonderful inside the Bothell Ward. That's as far as I can go. But inside that ward are wonderful people that serve, that are all along the spectrum of belief, and they are the most wonderful people that I've met. And they have changed my life. The only perfect people are the ones you don't know. And once you know them, everybody's got something. And that's what happens as a bishop. You hear their stories. And as you do, it becomes a situation where in all my... You can call that office a common judge, but I have done hardly any judging, far less judging as a bishop than I ever did when I was just sitting in the congregation. Because when I was in the congregation, I had lots of opinions about who was what, and I don't. It broke it down. So So for me, I've looked at it as an opportunity to grow. It's a path. It's what life is. And frustrating at times, but wonderful at times, and I'm grateful for it. Thanks.
Wouldn't we all like to have a bishop like him? And I agree. I think I can't imagine a better bishop to have than, you know, somebody with all the shades of gray instead of a black and white. All right, before I get started here, so when I was preparing this, what I thought I should just do is just take you through my journey. And I put some pictures together, and I started feeling like I'm probably being a little narcissistic, like anybody cares. So we had a little discussion about that. That kind of went a little crazy. It was funny. But I decided, hey, whatever. I'm here. You're just going to have to live with some pictures of me throughout my journey in life here. So I was born in Stockholm, Sweden, 1959. I'm actually younger than Jerilee, about 2 weeks, I think. My maternal grandmother, whom I was very, very close to, she was born in 1896, and she lived to be almost 94, so we got to have her around for quite a long time. I grew up hearing the stories of her life, and I so appreciated those stories, and I remember most of them still. They still live within inside of me. And yet I look at this woman who came from pretty meager circumstances. She was one of 10 children, and, you know, she never ever really made a ripple in the world in a sense, you know, in that sense. And yet, how important she was to me and her stories, how important they were to me. And it just really has dawned on me that every single human being has a really unique, very compelling story, and that's pretty fascinating to me. And I'm not here today, as you probably have already realized, as a scholar or some kind of expert. I'm just here to share my abbreviated version of my story. And before we move on, yes, English is not my first language. And so just bear with me. It's always being a little out of the comfort zone to give a public speak in English. Anyway. That's me and my grandmother. So Sweden, my beloved native land. So how do I find myself here? How do I find myself being an LDS in a country where the Mormon community is so small? Country has getting close to 10 million people. Supposedly there's about 10,000 plus members. But probably not even 2/3 of those are active still. Most people in my home country have never even heard of Mormons. So start by giving you a little bit of a historical perspective just to understand. Sweden has a state religion, just like if you heard the English woman here before. We have the Lutheran Church. Sweden was a very poor country going back just a little over 100 years ago. People were very, very poor and very oppressed. There was an elite of people that basically ruled everything and owned everything. Part of that was the church, the state church, the Lutheran Church. About between 1850 and 1920, close to about 1/4 of the population of Sweden emigrated over here. And one big reason for that was that we didn't even have religious freedom until 1921. So you've heard about these heathen Scandinavians, right? And heard about how hard it is to do missionary work in Europe, anywhere, but especially in Northern Europe. Well, this is my perspective. People call our country secular. I would say that's true to some degree. But we just have a very, very troubled relationship with organized religion. Religion or spirituality, it's not that people don't believe in God or have some kind of faith in some kind of higher power. But those are very, very intimate, private things. Swedes are great about talking about sex, but we don't talk about God. It's very different here. And then, of course, you mix in an American religion into that, and you certainly have a peculiar person. So, how did I end up here? So, I did not grow up in a religious home, like many Swedes, though I was christened in the Lutheran Church, which is tradition. But my dear grandmother, whom I mentioned, she taught me some children's prayers, she taught me some songs, and she would take me to the church every now and then, especially for Christmas. And she planted that little seed in me. When I got to first and second grade of school, we actually had a subject back in those days called Christian Studies. And we learned the stories from the New Testament of the life of Jesus. And I loved it. I just sucked it in. And that love for this person named Jesus started to grow. When I was 14 years old, I joined a group where we studied with a Lutheran priest. She was actually, you can see her up there. There you will see a male priest, and then she's in a black dress. Anyway, she was actually one of the very first Lutheran female priests. I think she became a priest like in the late 60s. So we went once a week and studied the Bible and talked about, you know, faith-related issues for 1 year. And it led up to being going through the communion, being confirmed is what it was called, partaking of the communion. And we had a lot of interesting discussions. And they gave me a Bible, and I went home, and I started reading the Bible. And over almost 2 years, took me about 2 years, but I read the whole darn thing. My poor mom, I started joining the church too, the Lutheran church. I joined the youth group. But I went on a search. I also had religious studies in school. I had a great teacher. I was definitely his favorite student. And I started reading about different Christian religions. Like I said, my poor mom, I think she thought, was wondering what was going on, but she thought this was a fad that was going to, eventually, I would get over. And I'm thinking sometimes, you know, we were talking about, we all grew up in the church. Well, this was kind of my youth revolt, I think. I had it there. It was just a little reversed. I didn't go out to pubs. Oh, I did that too before this. Then I started going to church. Here's a cute picture. About that same time, the Osmonds came into my life. I became one of their biggest fans. One thing that really drew me to them was the fact that they were religious. And I don't know if I like them because of their lifestyles or vice versa. Maybe it's a little both. But that actually eventually led me to contact the missionaries. So I actually called up the missionaries myself. I was scared to death. And that ended up me being baptized at the age of 16. And that was 41 years ago, almost exactly. When I did this, took this step, I was fully set on giving my new religion everything in my life, my whole life. And I really have. I went full in. I turned into Molly Mormon. I carried that role so well. I had lists of things, like monthly lists, like the second I was going to do this and the third I was going to do that to perfect myself. I eventually chose what I went to school. You know, I have a teaching degree, early childhood education, because I was going to be a good mom, right? I read the scriptures. I prayed. I fasted. Of course, 24 hours. You cannot do 23 hours and 59 minutes. And my whole existence has been the church. I threw myself wholeheartedly into it. And I thought, for example, that I would convert everybody. I would do things like, I would sit in a packed subway in Stockholm reading my Book of Mormon or my Liahona and making sure everybody could see what I was doing. Because, of course, if I would understand the truth, surely if they would just listen, everybody else would understand it too. Of course, this never happened. I don't think I've converted anybody. If anything, they probably were a little worried about my fanaticism. Eventually, I got married, and I was sealed in a temple in Switzerland, and later became the mother of four perfect children. So they're all adults. And three of them are in Stockholm, one is in Norway. Oslo, I should say. Well, that's in Norway. And yes, I'm a grandma, which is the coolest thing ever. And I have been one of the rocks of the church in Sweden. Besides serving in pretty much every leadership calling a woman can have, I have worked in public affairs. I have been part of the translation team. And this is both a curse and a blessing when you're out in the mission field, is that you get to do everything. And I have done everything. I have organized youth conferences almost as big as Sunstone. I have put on dance shows that were performed in the middle of downtown Stockholm for, you know. I could go on. It's crazy. But I have learned so much, and I've loved every minute of it. Just a little bit about the church in Sweden, too. You know, we don't, like I said before, we don't have a lot of members there, but the church is, in general, very strong. A lot of very successful, well-educated people. And so we're not lacking the leadership there. More the membership. And yes, I do know Hans Mattsson, and yes, I have a lot of insight into the Swedish Rescue, if you have any questions about that. But I won't go into that here now. I have loved being part of this community, though. It's a very close-knit community. I've loved raising my kids in there, and I can certainly see all the good fruits that I feel like the church has given me in my life. And I have no regrets. However, about 10 years ago, I went through a divorce after about 25 years of temple marriage. Even though I initiated this, it was, of course, a long process before it happened to, it was like throwing myself off of a cliff. And it was by far the hardest thing I've ever done in my life this far. I knew I had to get out, and knew it was the right thing to do. But you feel the pressure. I felt like I let everyone in that beloved, close-knit community down. The primary children, the youth, my neighbors, because I was an example too. That's another one of those curses you have when you live out in the mission field, that you feel like everybody's looking at you, and you're Mormon, so everything you do will be. But anyway, also my extended family, because what the church stands for is the family, right? And I'm still the only member of my extended family. And if I look back now, it was that divorce that was the real huge paradigm shift for me. Because even though I felt like people continued to be loving and supporting, my role in the church just changed like this. I was no longer part of a stereotypical Mormon community, or Mormon family, I should say, and that made the lens by which I look through things completely different. It just changed drastically. And it became so obvious that my position in the church was no longer what it had been now when I wasn't part of the nuclear family anymore. So where am I now presently in this journey? Well, you know, there is a Facebook status that says it's complicated, right? And I think that fits in very well. My relationship with God, I feel, is very good. I have a very strong, very grounded faith in God. My relationship with the institutional church is more troubled. But you know what, dang it. This is my spiritual home. I made this choice once, and I belong here. With or without my doubts, I'm still active, though I don't go full in like I used to. You know, I can actually confess, you know, it's okay to say that 8 hours of general conference is pretty boring. And when I go on vacation, I don't have to desperately find a branch to go to church every Sunday. It's been, you know, liberating. And yes, Eventually, I got married about 4 years ago. My first love, actually. That's a long story in itself. We met when I was 16, but we took a little detour. And about just a little over 4 years ago, I packed my bags and I moved here to America, to Utah County, no less. That's a long story in itself. But needless to say, moving here has been a challenge in itself. One of the things that I realize, even though we have this close-knit community, there is a way when you, the further away from Salt Lake you live, you can kind of back out a little bit and say, that's how they do it there, but we don't really have to do it here. Well, now I'm in the midst of it, and I can't really do that. I have to look at it face to face, and that has made my shift too. The troubling effect American, especially Utah culture and politics have had have on the institutional church is a whole other subject, and there was a panel about this this morning with Gina. And I really feel a lot of times like a strange liberal fish stuck swimming in a very wrong pond here. As one of my dearest friends here once said, I'm a bad, bad cultural Mormon. And I love that because that's how I feel. I think many of the core principles of the gospel are beautiful. The nature of God, the nature of potential of us humans, I love that. The belief that we have a Heavenly Mother, many of the rituals and the ordinances, I still love them. The 13th article of faith, for example. The thought of sealing loved ones together for eternity, though I don't really know exactly what that's going to look like, but it's an endearing thought anyway. Whatever happened to that beautiful principle of free agency? My testimony today, if you so wish, is I believe in the gospel as I mainly understand it from the New Testament, a gospel of love, inclusion, and forgiveness. Not one of inches on my skirt, not one of how much I pay in tithing, if at all, not one of sameness and fear. And this probably means that I will never again hold another leadership calling in the church, but I guess I've come to terms with that too. I believe in obedience, but I have reconstructed that word for myself. I have to be obedient to my own heart. I will not stand in front of my Maker one day having to say, well, he told me so. And if there is a God out there, then I have a right to personal revelation about my life. This is the gospel I love. You read about the principles of Jesus Christ. This is not an easy journey to be on, and I still don't know where it will take me. There are days when I simply don't know what I believe anymore. But at the same time, it has been so liberating to claim back some of my own autonomy, allowing myself to cherry pick. You know what? I don't believe polygamy was ever of God. And it's so wonderful to be able to say that. I don't. And I don't care what you say. I don't believe it. I don't think the church's stubborn stance against LGBT brothers and sisters is either. I believe our leaders can be hardworking, mostly good men, but they are just that. They are men. And they are products of their era and their culture, and they were born and bred and marinated in it. And I tell you as a Swede, if I hear another story of being born on a Utah farm, you know, that just... Anyway. I believe women should have more authority. And I don't believe there is one cookie-cutter ideal by which to live your life, especially for us women. And I could go on. But the most liberating thing for me recently is that I have allowed myself to cast off that heavy burden that I used to have of having to be perfect the Mormon way. You all know this one. Therefore, I would that ye should be perfect, even as I or your Father who is in heaven be perfect. When you study this word, though, I find it so interesting, you know, when the translation, what does this really mean? And I'm no scholar. I know, Dan, you can probably have opinions about this. But you look at what this word, the root of this word. In Hebrew, it was tamin, Greek, telios, something like that. And the translations, you know, I've worked with translations a lot. A lot of times words don't match up exactly. But what I found was that this word means more: to be complete, to be whole, to be mature, and to be healthy. Complete, whole, mature, healthy. And let's look at this scripture here again. Therefore, I would that ye should be complete, whole, mature, healthy, even as I, or your Father who is in heaven, is. And it just has been so, you know, what a different perspective. Let me just end with the following quote. And this is a new one, and I just heard it the other day when you were interviewing Carolyn. And I just started reading her new book, The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy. But this is what she said. Let me read the whole thing. When heaven has an earthquake, you fall to your knees and feel through the rubble to find the pieces of God. Now, of course, she was, you know, she's had her share, and she's talking about what she went through with her late husband. In my case, it was that divorce, too. She says just that here. When my eternal temple blessed marriage shattered and everything lay in jumbled shards around me, I had to slowly and carefully pick up every single piece and examine it, turning it over and over to see if it was worthy to keep and to use in building a new house with meaning. As I gathered the broken pieces of God, I used only my own authority. Only my own authority with the divine and the good small voice that speaks inside me to appraise them. I threw many away and I kept many. Assembling the bright pieces into one great thought, I asked only, do I see God's fingerprints on this? Does this little piece feel godly? Does it speak of love? That made it easy. I was forever finished with the insane attempt to love a God who hurts me. When I picked up the little piece of God-ordained polygamy, in this case, but it could be anything, I smiled because there was no question. I thanked God of love, and I threw that piece away. Thank you.
I'm going to still set myself a timer, though, Dan. So I'm a little bit of the oddball in this group for many reasons. The first one is, I guess I'm the youngster on the panel. I turned 50 in October, though, so I'm not super young. But for those of you that are here at Sunstone, you obviously know that there's a lot of us in this midlife faith crisis, and you know how tough that can be. Richard Bushman, just a few weeks ago, I made a comment where he said Elder Packer had the sense of protecting the little people. He felt like the scholars were the enemy to his faith and that of the grandmothers living in San Pete County. That was a very lovely pastoral image, but the price of protecting the grandmothers was the loss of the grandsons. I feel like that has really hit my family right between the eyes. We are squarely between correlation and inoculation. I watch my kids. Yes? Oh, all right. Yeah.
Because I know that in another session they used that black microphone.
Is this any better? Okay. All right, we'll try this one. Anyway, as I was saying, I think we are squarely between inoculation or correlation and inoculation. When I watch what my kids are going through, and they're having great discussions on things that I never even heard of until just, you know, a year or so ago. And so I think ours is kind of, my wife and I have talked, we're kind of a lost generation in a lot of ways. We're the disposable generation that they just don't know what to do with, and I don't either. I don't have any answers for that, but it is difficult. In another way, I'm a little bit different than these folks. I think their spouses are all here and fairly much on the same page. My wife, the healthiest place for her right now is to be kind of away from Mormonism, and so I grant that to her, and hope that she finds her happiness. My background, it was all really good growing up in the church. I when I was a teenager, got into some unhealthy behaviors, and my wife, who I met as a teenager, when she was 16, I was 17, she kind of got me back on the straight and narrow, and I had a fantastic bishop that put his arms around me and did everything right, and just helped me in a way that worked for me, and it was really a very good experience. So I ended up serving a mission. We got married in the temple. We had four kids. One of them is a returned missionary. They're four daughters, actually, so... it was estrogen fest at our house with the five women, two female dogs, and me as the token male. And I have a daughter that's a missionary. I have a second daughter that she's at grad school up here at the U in biomechanical engineering. And I'm thankful for President Hinckley for kind of pushing my daughters to go get all of the education that they can get and be everything that they can be. It's a different generation than we grew up in, and I'm very happy to see how successful and happy my kids are being. My wife and I were both serving in state callings about 3 years ago, and we just kind of appeared to have the perfect family. I had a brother-in-law who left the church after being a bishop, and my wife one day decides to find out why, so she's going to go to Fair Mormon and figure out all the answers and give them to him. That was back in the day when Fair had a banner down the side that listed every single problem with the church. And so she went on there one day to look up something on polygamy, and A to Z, there it was, and she's like, Book of Abraham, what is up with that? So she clicked on that, clicked on the next one, clicked on the next one, and when in one afternoon she said that the switch just flipped for her, and she was out. It went from all 100% true and accurate to all 100% lies and deceit and just an awful place to be in one afternoon. I didn't know anything about this at the time. I'm going along as most guys do, completely clueless to everything that's going on in the family. About December 2013, she starts dropping a couple of hints that maybe she's got some disagreements with the church, and I thought, well, this is really odd. I've always been kind of a slacker in the church. I mean, for me, NFL stood for No Family Night, ladies. So, Monday Night Football was where it was at for me. So I've never been the greatest member. I've never been a bad one either, really. But in about 2013, I figure it's time for me to step up my game because my wife is probably getting tired of me being a slacker. So I go all in. And, I mean, I'm bringing Elder Holland talks for family home evening. And, I'm really going to take charge and, be the father that I should have been for 30 years. And so anyway, at that point, in March of 2015, my wife tells me that she believes it's all, everything that I believe in, she doesn't believe in anymore, and it's a big fairy tale, and it's all made up. And, that was so hurtful to me that I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, and over the next 30 days, I lost 30 pounds just from the stress of that knowledge. So at some point, I travel a lot for work, and I go to Australia. It takes about 52 to 54 hours to actually get from where I live to the mine site, so I have a lot of time in my own head. So I decided, I'm going to look into all of the issues that my wife has and figure out, we'll get on the same page together. And she got really excited about that, I think, and basically thought, he'll read everything, he'll agree with me on everything. And so did I. I thought, I'll at least understand everything. So I went through it all, and I couldn't have been more wrong. We both came to two completely different responses to the same information. We read the CES letter, we read... listen to a lot of Mormon Stories podcast, Mormon Expression with John Larson. We listen to, the Infants on Thrones guys. We listen to all of the stuff that was going to tell us, was supposed to convince me that this was all a big lie. And I came out of it, I read Rough Stone Rolling and came out of it thinking, yeah, that actually makes a lot more sense to me than the story that I was told originally, because that's how I felt like I was as a person, so... Anyway, my problem wasn't so much the faith crisis for myself, but it was dealing with a marriage crisis at the same time. And those of you that are only dealing with the faith crisis, you have it easy. So, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not making light of anybody's pain. So, no, it's tough. But the only thing I've ever really, really wanted in life was a family. I wanted my family, and I wanted us all to be together. And watching a big part of our family take a big divergent path just tore me up, still tears me up to this day. And that's what I struggle with and where I have a lot of work left to do. And I need to get better at a lot of different things. If you're on a Thoughtful Faith, you've heard Jerilee talk about the word. It's a Welsh word. I can't pronounce it. Jerilee, maybe you can help. Hiraeth? Hiraeth? Okay, close enough. There's no English word that's a direct translation, but the University of Wales Lampeter defines it as a homesickness tinged with grief or sadness over the loss of or departed. It is a mix of longing, yearning, nostalgia, wistfulness, and earnest desire. And that's really my biggest problem right now, is just that feeling of loss and that wish to go back to how things used to be. We're supposed to give tips and tricks for making this a little easier, so maybe I'll throw out a few. I've made all of the mistakes you can possibly make as a believer. For those of us that are believers, don't tell exmos that there is a sifting going on or to stay strong or anything like that. That is so offensive. And for exmos, don't give the analogy of climbing out of a cave into the light and everybody that's left in the cave is still in the dark. And don't say that somebody's sacred beliefs are just a fairy tale like Santa Claus. I mean, that's hurtful too. So I guess my advice would be to be careful with your words and be kind. Be kind to yourself, and especially be kind to people who think differently than you. Find a mentor. Be a healer. Dan has mentioned on his podcast about Randy Paul, and I've been lucky enough to go out to dinner a few times with Dan and Lori and Jerilee and Lance, and Dan has really been my mentor. As we call her, Bishop Renshaw of the ATF ward. Bishop Renshaw has been my mentor, too, and just really helped give me the female perspective on how to validate my wife and just to show love. I love the quote from Tom Christofferson was actually quoting Bob Reese on a podcast of Dan's the other day. He said, "There are two kinds of Mormons that I distrust, those who only think and those who never think." And then he went on to say, "There are two kinds of Mormons I distrust, those who only feel and those who never feel." I think the healthiest decisions, and if you just went to the Mormon mental health session, having a good balance, we do our best thinking when we have a good balance of feeling and intellectual study. If you need to take a sabbatical, do what Jana Reese did. Take a sabbatical, if that's what you need to do to be healthy. Believe that you might be wrong, and that will open you up to new possibilities of a lot of learning. And don't try and rebuild exactly what you had. If your faith testimony was knocked down, you can build something back up that's equally as beautiful, but it won't be the same, and that's okay. It can be different. It can be better than it was, stronger. And the final piece of advice came from Dialogue, where I read something once that said, if you're going through hell, keep going. You know? So I think that's great advice. Thank you. And just one more thing, it's Dan Weatherspoon's birthday today. Jerilee talked me into doing this, so it's her fault, Dan. You can blame her. Can we all join in with a quick happy birthday for Dan?
And I'm this 1959er with these guys, so we're all the same age. So, yes, a few months younger. So I'm the baby. We have 25 minutes. If you will, please go to that microphone. If you're not comfortable coming up, Lance, would you pass and take the mic to anybody that? But we'd really love to catch this on the recording. But bring your stories, your pain, your questions, whatever you came here for that maybe you didn't catch.
All right, I'll go first. First, I want to thank you for all your stories. I find them very very helpful, and that certainly I can relate to that. The question I have is, as my wife and I are going through our own faith transition, and which is probably been going on for a good 3 years now, One of the challenges that we're having right now is with our children. So I'd like to know kind of how you've done that with your children. We have four kids. Our two oldest kids are just graduated college. We have our youngest is 15. We have a daughter that just has graduated high school. And as our two oldest children are not in the church, but as my wife and I talk at home, we try to be careful with our conversations, yet obviously our kids hear us talk. And just a week ago, our son, who is 15, he was at home, he was crying, he was in tears, because as he's been home this summer for school break, he'd been reading the CES letter, he'd been reading the church essays, and so now our crisis is now bleeding over into our youngest son. And so that's kind of the challenge, is we want to be honest and have these discussions with our own kids. So I'm just curious, as you've gone through that and you have your own children, how you've dealt with that, or anyway.
That's a really good question. Is this mic working? Okay. Hold it all the way up. That's a really good question. It's one that comes up in our online group a lot, and I wish I had like the perfect answer for you. I think it varies for different people. For my husband and I, my kids certainly know that we are on a journey because they know of our oldest sons, but we haven't necessarily felt the need to drop all the bombs in their lap. And, you know, just you mentioned the CES letter. That's not ever one of my favorite resources. It doesn't give a lot of context to things. For those of you who might not be aware, there's a website called Mormonism in Context, which I would highly recommend. Brian Whitney, who's a part of our group, and we refer to him as our ATF historian, has put that together. He keeps it updated. It's really a great resource. It does not whitewash things, but it doesn't approach things from an angry or, you know, necessarily negative way. It just kind of tells it like it is. So I would recommend that. I know that people in our group have talked about using that for family home evenings with their kids. It's a little harder, I think, when your kids get older. But I think teaching our children, you know, I think about this all the time because it was much later in life for us when this happened. So we didn't have kids at home. How would I have done this differently? I don't completely know the answer, except teaching our children to be critical thinkers and that things are complicated and that they're messy. And that the stories aren't always exactly the way we hear it in the correlated manuals, I think, is really important. I wish I had the magic answer for you, but I would use that resource. The CES letter to me is kind of like dropping a grenade in somebody's lap and walking away, you know? Doesn't leave them with a lot of support or a lot of resources, and I think that's a tough one. Not everybody feels that way about it. That's just my own view on it. So anybody else have anything they want to say about kids? Kevin?
Well, I have a 16-year-old daughter at home right now. The three oldest are Temple married and kind of on their way, so they're aware that my wife and I have had our challenges with our beliefs. But basically something Dan said, honor the journey. And I think for age appropriate, it's a different situation for each age. With our 16-year-old daughter, we've just tried to teach values rather than doctrine or principles or things like that. So we focus on the values that we still have in common. The other thing, too, Thomas McConkie said something the other day at Gerald Lee's house, actually. He talked about a butterfly that got pulled out of the chrysalis. You know, somebody thought they were trying to help the butterfly by getting it out, and it never had a chance to pump and work and struggle and really develop, and it never flew, that butterfly. And I like that metaphor. Thomas is a very zen kind of dude, and I really like him for that. But I think at the appropriate time, and I think Fowler would agree with this too, Dan, that it's age appropriate as to when you need to be pulled out of stage three. And, you know, for us, my 16-year-old daughter is not at that point yet, so we just work on values.
Such the key, you know, the key thing. And I have a 28-year-old son who's out of the church, hasn't been excommunicated, but he's a great teacher for all of us. And we have a 22-year-old daughter who just was married in the temple a few months ago. At one point in my life, I felt like our son didn't stick with the gospel because he was, you know, he was there when I was tossing over tables, you know, or kicking over chairs at home, and I couldn't help but have my explosions after coming home from church and things like that. And so I carried a little bit of you know, trauma in my own heart about that. Ultimately, I've realized this is an uncorrelatable soul. It made zero difference. People are going to journey. And he was the kind of kid that told us when he's 16, he goes, "Hey, man, as soon as I'm out of high school, I'm out of here. I love you guys. It has nothing to do with you, but I'm going to make my way in the world." And he has. He's, you know, maybe lent him $500 over 10 years. You know, he's just one of those kids that says, "I'm going to go do life." By the time he got to our daughter, well, first of all, I don't sound like you're making what I think is a mistake, which is that idea, I've got to deconstruct everything that happened at church. You know, make them tell me what their teachers said or something so I can, you know, give them the our spin on it. I really think that that's not necessary because you're the 24/7 person. You're the one that values is what sticks and things like that. But if you signal to them that you're approachable and able to talk about anything, then that's what's going to happen when they come up. Our daughter, we had a wonderful moment when she was about 15 years old, and they put in a new young women's presidency that Lori and I were a little bit shaky about as far as they seemed to be quite, you know, aggressively conservative women. And after a couple of weeks or something like that, we decided to approach our daughter with the idea of, you know, people live the gospel in different ways, and there's all sorts of different ways to be a believer. And if just because you hear something at Young Women's or something like this, and it was the perfect 15-year-old response. She just gave you the duh. You know, she did not want to talk with you. And then she goes, and part of that duh was, "I live with you guys." You know? And ever since that point, you know, this is the daughter that when John and Kate were getting excommunicated, she heard about it enough. "Dad, are you going to be in trouble too?" You know, she's aware of who I am and where I am and where my wife is and stuff like that, who's also on the journey of these different things. And we just know that she's not thrown by things. So we felt like the healthiest thing that we had done. I had calmed down during those years. I was figuring out a way to make it work when we were living with her, but just don't try to fix them. Just let them come to you, I think. It's the best.
This is really to Matt on the question. You said your ward is really a perfect place. What do you do to insulate them from the bigger church? Things that happen at General Conference that might not be loving and careful to everybody in the ward, and how do you help them to work through that?
Well, I think, you know, you find that there's a lot of the members that really like what they hear, so they're not in crisis that way. I think my concern in that ward is that I don't get to talk to all those that are feeling upside down or concerned. And so you hope that you can signal to them that you are approachable and that you want to talk. We have Fifth Sunday lessons that I usually teach, and I try to bring up things that are more open and perhaps a little bit more liberal, mm-hmm. just because I think they're good to discuss. And then also is maybe a way to signal that, hey, you know what, we had one on doubts. And if you're feeling any doubts, you can come to me and talk to me. I'd love to hear from you. But I think you find that those will come to you. So if there are issues with what they've heard, you know, November 5th was, you had certain people that wanted to talk about it. And so you have to kind of wait for them to come to you, like Dan says, because I don't know who they are, obviously. Right. But yeah, so I hope that...
Yeah. It seems like things go well for a while and then November happens, you know, or conference happens and there's one talk that just rubs the wrong way, and the counsel you give to your children or to your, you know, yeah. family members or spouse or whatever has to be in a way that is, I know what they're saying might be inspirational to some people, but it doesn't have to fit for everybody.
Yeah, and I think, like I say, the only way I'm going to know those are the ones that do approach me on it. I don't go out and try to say, it looks like you had a problem with Bednar. And so, but if they do, then honestly, most of it is just listening and saying, hey, I know where you're at. I mean, I've felt that way too.
Okay, thanks.
Bishop from Seattle. I don't want to embarrass you, but about a year ago, a bishop from Seattle put out was it in the paper? They invited all of their gay, non-member, inactives to come to their ward.
Outreach. It was an outreach. It was actually the state.
Yes, it was.
It was the whole stake.
Was it from the stake?
No, it wasn't our stake, but it was the whole stake.
Well, I actually cut that article or something and sent it to my son. I told him to find spirituality somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't think he went, but...
So the hard part of that one, honestly, was that stake president did that thing and really opened up, and it was very well received, but then there was a bit of a kickback later, and that was just very difficult if you were on the receiving end of someone coming in and saying, we're glad you're here, to have that policy come out and go, you cannot tell me. That's the ultimate bait and switch. You can't tell me that I have to go back out now and find those people and do something. That never happened, but there was a bit of concern that you had to recoil, tell them to take a hike after you invited them to come in. Actually, and maybe I'm mistaken, but the one that we had, which was a couple of years ago, was actually to the gay brothers and sisters that we have in the area. And yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So that was, I think that was where the outreach was too. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
It was wonderful. Thank you all, panelists. My question is, how do you foster open dialogue in your wards? You know, you mentioned, Matt, that you, in the fifth Sunday, you know, you kind of hopefully break the ice. But are there other forums that you've been able to create to have dialogue? I mean, Sunstone, this is wonderful to be able to have dialogue here, but it'd be nice to have a little more opportunities in our local units. I'll sit down. Thank you.
I think I get away with a lot by just being a foreigner. You know, I'm the strange one anyway. So I can make comments, and I've even stood up in, you know, fast and testimony meeting and said probably things that doesn't always, I don't know, might have rubbed people the wrong way. But, you know, I am the foreigner, so, yeah, we kind of let it, you know. I feel like I just get away with a lot more than Richard does, for example. But I also believe it's how you say things. You know, it's easy to fall into the trap of wanting to change people and want to kind of lay the book down on them, you know. And I don't know. I don't have the answer. But I feel like what I've tried to do is more approach it with a question. Don't you think, you know, or have you thought of that? Or don't you think this would be hurtful? Or can we look at it this way? Or something like that. That just kind of takes a little bit of the edge off. But yeah, I it's interesting. I feel like I get away with so much more than Richard does in our ward. One thing we did too was shortly after the the policy, you know, change came out in November. And... yeah, that was confusing and hurtful, I especially saw Richard. I see a lot more anger there. I think I've been able to kind of, I don't know, I kind of carve out my own way, I think, because I chose this once and I keep choosing it. But there was still a lot of confusion in my heart. We invited our bishop and his wife over for dinner. I had a long, good heart-to-heart conversation with him because we felt like we needed to be honest with him. And of course, it, you know, it's that leadership roulette, right? And we have a great bishop. But it was good. It was cathartic. Is that the word? Anyway, I think for
us to be come out and, you know, come clean to him and in that setting and be honest. And it works. Well, we got released from our callings. I was in the primary, but I don't know if it has anything to do. Yeah. Now I write the newsletter.
This is going to vary from ward to ward, depending on, you know, how open your leadership is as far as whether you can, you know, give a nuanced chalk and sacrament meeting or not, which I haven't had that experience. But I did have an experience in a tough ward that we were in about a year ago where a comment was made in Sunday school, and it was actually a woman I knew who was an employee of the church, and she raised her hand in a Sunday school class and said, you know, my husband and I were just talking last night that everybody we know who's left the church has something they need to repent of. And I think I made an audible groan in class, and I had a friend sitting next to me and my husband on the other side, and my hand went up because that was not my experience with my son, right? It wasn't about that. And I said, and I think this is really key, is finding words that are not threatening to other people. I said, you know, in my experience, there are some very difficult things out there. Of course, my ward had no idea how much I know, right? And the church had been rolling out these essays. So I said, you know, there's a whole series of essays on LDS.org that are dealing with some of these very difficult doctrinal and historical issues. And I think that this is really a very real struggle for a lot of people. And we need to be careful about categorizing them as, you know, they've got something they need to repent of, and so they leave the church or whatever. And shortly after that, within a few weeks, I had a knock at my door, and someone in my neighborhood, it was a woman, was at my door, and she said, you said something in church a few weeks ago. I feel like you get it. Can I talk to you? And she came in. Her husband's a pilot. He was out of town. And she stayed till, I think, after midnight talking to my husband and I. So sometimes when you can just say a little something, put in a plug for the fact that there are difficulties, it opens up, you know, opportunities to have discussions with other people who are feeling alone.
Those are great, great comments. I'm also interested in hearing, in addition, and please, Matt, would love to hear that. What... these are kind of one-on-one sorts of experiences, and that's great. How can we institutionalize more openness for questioning and expressing doubts and having a forum for that to occur and so that these things come out rather than having to wait for somebody to come to you? You know, you can sort of bring people in, have them hear it, inoculate them, that kind of thing. So, yes.
I think we had, after the policy, I did a lesson in Relief Society that was really, really good, and it was on Tom Christofferson before he got rebaptized. And I just told the story, and we went through it before we named who it was and got all the way to the end before we said, does anybody know who this is? And somebody raised their hand and said, yes, it's Elder Christofferson's brother. But we had a discussion on, would you allow that partner to be in the family picture? That was a question, and it was somewhat charged, and this is where I feel like I just take hope in it. In the Bothell ward, is that there were some that you would never have thought that would have been right down the line and said there's no way, and they were like, absolutely. They gave you hope that there was some openness to some movement. As to how that conversation can happen wider than my ward, I don't know. but we will until they release me.
I have another thought. I have a brother who's a stake president in my hometown, in my town where I live. He's not my stake president. But some friends of mine live in his stake, and they are really struggling with a lot of things. And they went to their bishop and said, can we have a class in our ward where we talk about the essays? So that's not coming out through correlation, right? But there is a manual, I can't remember what it's called, that they've been using. She's talked about it in our group. I could find out. It went to the stake president. Lisa, you probably know.
It's the new institute
manual. Okay, it's the new institute manual. Do you remember what it was called? I don't know. Okay, so there's a manual out, and that's kind of their outline, what they're using. So they went to my brother, the stake president, and said, can we do this? Like, in our word, can we talk about the essays, you know? Well, it would have never happened if somebody didn't ask, right? So it's been happening. They're now on their same round. They've been through the second round. They've been through all the essays once, and they're doing it again. So I think those kind of things, if it's important to you, if you want to open up dialogue, we really should be able to talk about those kind of things. They're on LDS.org in church, right? That would be awesome. So that would be my suggestion, is to ask, can we do that?
I have a question for Matt. So being a bishop, and I'm assuming, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that you have somewhat nuanced view about the priesthood. So how do you, being the bishop in that position, having to deal with a lot of priesthood responsibilities, authority, blessings, all that, how do you do that? Because for me, that's a struggle. Like, I'm feeling, how can I stay in the church and deal with that? And then another little question for you is temple recommend questions. So, being in your position, how do you manage that?
Okay, so but on the priesthood side, you mean from the specific of the authority that we have the authority to do this thing?
Yes, or believing. Yeah, that we have the authority to do this thing, or that we have the power to.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
To give blessings and have things happen.
Right. Right.
That type of thing.
I think in my nuanced view of how that works, I see that as it is a privilege of mine to lay my hands on someone's head and give them a blessing that is based in love. As to my hope that is somehow effectual, I'm probably in the boat with everyone else where I don't know if it will. But I guess the way I see it, Lance, is I just say I'd be honored to give you. Who doesn't want a blessing? But I see it in my nuanced view as an opportunity to express my Heavenly Father's love to that person. So that's the way I see that. Temple recommend questions. It is, who was it today? I think it was in the Borderlands that said, how did he say that? I have faith. I'll take that on faith. And from my standpoint, if someone says that, just what he said, I'm fine with that. I say, go. go to the next interview. I've had times where I've felt that somebody had such a nuanced view that I have cautioned them about how to answer on the next level.
It's 6:30. It's time to go to dinner and get back for tonight. Thank you, everyone. And we'll see you. Hopefully go to the amazing session tonight.